Sometimes life feels out of our control. We get stuck in trauma, old patterns, and change feels out of reach. Sometimes it feels like fate. We want to help you break out of old, unhelpful patterns and become healthier. We're Fate Resilience, taking control of the outcome.
With licensed therapists, Jennifer Oxford,
Taylor Madsen,
Haley Mayer.
Well, guys, today we are going along with our deep and heavy topics, and we are well aware these are deep and heavy topics. One of the reasons we are well aware of it is because we are feeling it ourselves. So going in line with the whole idea of checking in with your body, one of the reasons we keep reiterating this idea that this is not a series of episodes to listen to one after the other isn't because we're like, you can't handle it. We are therapists and we talk about this all day, and it's not so much that anyone can't handle it. It's the idea of there's a reason our body is considering these traumas. You shouldn't try to put your body through trying to figure this all out all at once. And so it's good to learn all these different things, but take a break, take some pace, you know, go touch some grass, do something. And so I think we just want to give the information and make it available so that we can definitely refer to it as we go on. But today specifically, we're talking about sexual abuse, sexual assault. And we all have our own backgrounds with helping people with this and personal experience of what it's looked like to.
We've all helped victims of human trafficking, all three of us.
Yeah. And so we're well aware of these scenarios, and we understand there's a lot that goes into it. So we again are going to talk and touch on general concepts. There are always specifics, and if you have questions about your own specific scenario, please don't hesitate to talk to your therapist, message us, ask us questions. We would love to help you. It's like that whole ball of yarn scenario you see in those memes, and the therapist is there to help unravel it. We are here to help you with that. But we are just going to talk on generals for it. So I think the first thing is just identifying the definition of what is sexual assault, what is sexual abuse, and what the differences of that is. Who has a good definition of that? Which of us?
Abuse is any contact of erogenous zones of anyone under 18, over 65, pregnant or disabled. For pregnant or disabled people, when they don't give consent, or if they're unable to give consent, or any voyeurism or exhibitionism or non-consensual pornography viewing or making for those populations. And then also of prisoners, because they are unable to give consent, would be just a basic definition for abuse.
And I think what I like that you said there is that now we need to remember that in protected populations like children and elderly and disabled, it doesn't matter always whether they give consent, because there can be, and we'll talk about, manipulation of those populations. And then the idea that abuse can happen anytime there's not consent.
Yeah, they might say yes, but that doesn't mean that they're capable of giving consent.
Correct.
Now, assault is anyone over 18 and under 65 and pregnant or disabled that are capable of giving consent but do not give consent.
Well, and I want to clarify, if you're over 65 and can give consent, you can still... that can still happen.
Thank you for adding that clarification.
I think we can, just in general too, with these kinds of scenarios, those are the definitions that are written out. Like us, especially as practitioners, and you in the real world. We're not in the real world, just kidding. But for those with practical experience, like anyone and everyone, right? Like broad range of the spectrum. We specifically, under the age of 18, there are specific things. When I went through my practicum, I had to do like a 5-day training on sexual assault and what it looked like, and especially working with kids and things like that. And there's a whole range of definitions each state that's like certain acts are considered assault for the age, right? So it's like people under 14, if this and this and this happens, it's sexual assault. People under 15, this and this, right? So
Or even certain acts under like 18, for example, but there's an age gap of a certain years.
Yes. So there's so many different things with it. So it's we understand there's so many nuances, but I think when we're approaching the topic in general, we can just say any age, anything is going can be under consideration for that. But there, especially when it comes to the age of consent, which a lot of states have debates about what should be the age of consent, there's a whole big, like, detail-oriented area. We could spend a whole day talking about that, right? But I think for the sake of the topic, it's open.
Well, and Just a starting place.
unfortunately, it's open.
Sorry, Jen, go ahead.
One of the things I wanted to note too is that sometimes the question of whether it was abuse or assault is difficult, and that we're not here in this podcast to make that determination for you. We don't know, we're not talking about specific situations, but we want to talk about the problem is evasive, and it's very it's widespread. Among children, 1 in 5 girls have been reported as being sexually assaulted before the age of 18, and that's just one of the populations that we've looked at. So when we look at how pervasive this is, again, it is super pervasive,
And it's
and
like
I
1 in 10 for boys.
and that's what's known or reported. So there's, of course,
Yeah.
we have a concern that those numbers might be underreported. But if I just list for a minute, like, what some of the symptoms are and why this is such a big topic to think about is that we can look at their sleep issues related, especially because when abuse happens at night or is related to a bedtime routine or in the middle of the night, that can be a big issue. Panic attacks, dysfunctional relationships, and we can talk a little more about that part.
That's a broad term, yeah.
Addictions can be common, and because we're struggling to cope with the trauma that we felt. We're going to talk more about addictions in our next episode. Feelings of shame as the victim, loneliness, depression, anxiety can be increased, flashbacks can happen. Unhealthy behaviors is a really general term, but we do see people who experience abuse and assault having more unhealthy behaviors. Communication issues, feeling emotionally numb. This is a super long list. Being triggered. Chronic physical difficulties, so our physical health is impacted. This includes pain with consensual sexual activity, body and intimacy issues, and then dissociation is a common one too.
And then a few to add, especially for children, although this definitely happens in adults, is bedwetting, soiling themselves, especially while dressed, and then avoiding bathing or showering.
And these are all, like, I think we've already pretty much explained it, but these are all very much acts of protection that the kids, the adults, however it is, may not even recognize as them acting as protection, and especially their caretakers or caregivers may not recognize as acts of protection. And we'll kind of go into why those become acts of protection in that moment, but a lot of these symptoms are not because they're choosing to do that. It's not like I was hurt, therefore I'm going to do this. A lot of these are almost impulsive, like we talked about the brain going into fight, flight, freeze, fawn. This is 100% your body going into that without recognizing it and trying to do everything it can to keep you safe, even if we know it doesn't quite make sense. It's because, again, that part of the brain that's in the front that makes you do problem solving and things like that, that's not engaged when that entire body is feeling completely at harm, right? So we're just doing complete protection mode there.
Because sexual abuse and assault, and I might just use the word abuse, so just know that that includes
In
both of
this
them.
episode as a catch-all.
But because sexual abuse is a relational experience, in fact, 80% of children under the 18 are abused by somebody that they know versus a stranger, it also affects our perception of self. Our value, our worth, our attachments. You can go back to looking at what those attachments might look like. And we connect those attachments of, am I seen and known, worthy of love, with being abused and mistreated and not having consent. This leads into a lot of thought processes, pervasive belief systems about ourselves. And so we understand that this is a widespread issue, but it also has way more impact than I think a lot of people realize. In fact, I had worked for a while for a retreat for women who are survivors of childhood sexual abuse, and the amount of information that we had that we could help them understand how it was related to their abuse, many, many survivors were able to acknowledge that they were unaware of how pervasive the effects of their abuse were in their life.
One of the reasons why our sense of self is so impacted by sexual abuse and assault is because it's a double betrayal. This realm of trauma is a little unique. We're not just betrayed by someone close to us because they hurt us. Our own body betrays us. Our body is only wired to respond in one way. Sexual abuse and assault is absolutely painful, and there will still be a pleasure response during sexual abuse and assault. Not always, but often there will be. And that is incredibly confusing for someone that's been through sexual abuse and assault. They start to wonder if I must have wanted this, or I must have done something to make this happen for my body to respond this way. And that's not true. Our body is simply wired to respond that way. And so there's this betrayal from our own body if it responded that way.
And a lot of the times the abuser will use that as a way to gaslight the person they are abusing into saying that it isn't an abusive situation, that this is, you know, that this was an okay situation. This is something they wanted, because they know that that is a response that you can't help but having. A lot of people are like, well, if you really didn't want it, then you would be completely turned off and you wouldn't have that be an issue. Totally not a fact.
Right? Absolutely. I've worked with men that were assaulted, and despite being afraid and not wanting it to happen, they still had an erection, because that's just how it works.
And then the same for women, that's, you know, having that kind of a scenario, and especially having that information, people who commit these types of, you know, crimes, we're just going to call it as that, crimes, they will do what they can often to try to manipulate the facts of the scenario, which is another reason why the age of consent is a big thing to consider where you're at, but also just bottom line under the age of 18, with all of these kinds of scenarios that are happening, you're, as an 18-year-old or as someone who's younger, we're not saying that they're stupid, right? However, maybe. No,
we are saying that their prefrontal cortex is not fully developed.
Yes, they don't have the full equipment to make the decisions that they need to. And so with this understanding that my body has a reaction, whether or not my mind is engaged in making a complete, agreement to what's going on, that's why when we're talking about with minors, I have a lot of teenage clients and I love them all. We've all had teenage clients. We love them, but we look at them and we say, hey, you don't have the equipment to make the decision, this kind of a decision. And so you may be having a bodily reaction, but even adults have a hard time recognizing the difference between there is a physical reaction and an emotional, mental, I'm ready for this. And so that's why the age of consent is such a big deal for a lot of people to have to consider, and they should be considering. And unfortunately, lawmakers don't always support that whole idea, and it becomes a political issue. But that's why we, especially as therapists, talk a lot with our underage clients about why it's more than just the physical reaction, right? Because you want to have the opportunity to avoid sexual assault, you know, sexual violence type of situations. And so, yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to add too that it's more than just the relationship, because we see that a majority of minors are abused by people they know. Often there is rewards, emotional rewards for participating in sexual abuse, including feeling loved, connected, attention, gifts, safety. Would be considered a reward if I'm unsafe if I don't participate, and I'm safe if I do, that would be considered a reward. And so these are super complex issues for the prefrontal cortex to look at even as an adult, but they become much more survivalist mentality when we're looking at those who don't have full access to their prefrontal cortex.
And so these minors or people with disabilities, with developmental disabilities that have been victims of sexual abuse, will initiate sexual contact so that they have some sense of control over the encounter. And that doesn't mean that they are consenting or that they want the contact. Wanting a sense of control is a survival type of interaction.
In fact, one of the as we look at one of the parts of control that we see is the term hugging, and that actually one of the researched ways that we seek control is by being more attentive. And so a lot of
And you
people
don't mean
think
like the physical kind of like, hi, I haven't seen you in a while hug. Yeah, you're talking about like the fawn response we've said before, right?
Right, which is otherwise known as the fawn response, which is I'm being nice in order to control my safety, versus because I really want this, or I'm being compliant because this will get me a trip somewhere or a toy. That is a fawn response. And so a lot of people are like, what's a fawn response? And why don't we talk about it as much as a society is? Because it is hard for people to understand that we can make choices based on safety that might actually not be good for us, but that's very real.
And this kind of goes into consent as an overall topic, which is a big part of this, right? And a lot of people say that they have given consent, even non-minors, you have adults who are like, I totally gave consent. Then when you talked about it, they feel like there would have been some sort of consequence if they didn't, right? That their partner would have pulled away, that their partner would have been disappointed in them, that their partner would have maybe even been like completely angry with them, right? So as much as you can gain things from people, there's also the opposite, and both fall in line with this idea of consent, which I was always taught it's like, consent needs to be a hell yeah and a high five, right? Like both people are completely involved in it. Dr. Douglas Braun Harvey has a really great definition of consent that I also want to bring up with this scenario. So he says that consent is when essentially both people are saying, I want this experience to have an effect on me, to change me, and to give me something that I desire, and I want you to provide it for me, right? Meaning like I'm opening myself up to being vulnerable, and I want this experience to be more, for the both of us too. But I love that idea of this idea of both people committing to that. If one of the people in the partnership is not feeling that way, it automatically doesn't fall under consent, right? You can consent, but if your partner's not consenting, then the experience is not a consensual situation. Therefore, it needs to be paused, right? It can't continue. It's the idea that, the minute one person is not in that realm, automatically it's off the
What if
table.
in the middle of sex are men capable of stopping if consent is withdrawn?
I don't know, Taylor. Can you talk to the men and let me know?
I hear this from the mountaintops, written by the finger of God. Yes, men are capable of stopping in the middle of sex. And if they say no, that's either manipulation, or they have a very low opinion of themselves and think that they are less capable than a dog. A dog can hold a treat on its nose or ignore a steak on a table within their reach. Men are capable of stopping in the middle of sex.
And so I like you bring up that point too, is that consent isn't just at the very beginning, it's throughout the entire experience, right? If at any point during an experience with someone that it's not falling under that, that's when these terms we've been using. And I just also want to reiterate, in the moment, you don't have to try to figure out, is this sexual violence or sexual assault? It's not okay. Bottom line, like it's, we know the terms so we can classify them and kind of know with treatment what we need to do with it. But you don't need to also worry about which one is it. It doesn't feel okay. We're talking about the realm of sexuality in general and how it can be turned against someone and made into more of a weapon than a resource and a guide. And Taylor brings up a good point. There's no timeline that at this point all's good, right? You can do whatever you want. Consent needs to be throughout any experience you have. And if it's not, then it turns into one of those scary words that we're mentioning that may feel overwhelming, but in actuality, it's not truly benefiting either party, really.
It's unfortunate that people actually use consent to increase manipulation. So, for example, if you are told that if you don't do this, then I will harm somebody, or I will tell a secret, or I will post something on the internet that, and then somebody says, okay, I will do it. That is not considered full consent. That is considered manipulated. And so I think it's
That's
really,
considered blackmail too, right?
yes. But I think it's really important that we realize that there are times in which somebody who has been abusive will manipulate you into verbal consent, saying yes to a situation. But when they're holding something over you, whether that be safety, emotional, physical, social, or any kind of threat of retribution, or if you don't do this, then this will happen. Including if you don't act out with me, I will hurt myself. Those are all forms of manipulation and abuse. And so it's really important that I think we work really hard. Well, we've been working really hard as a society to understand consent. And I want to point out that people will also work really hard to get a verbal consent that may be manipulated.
The two most common forms of sexual assault that I see in couples, we work a lot with couples, is either the husband or boyfriend assaults the girlfriend or boy wife during their sleep until the girlfriend or wife responds sexually, because again, like we talked about, the body will is wired to respond that way. But when you're asleep, you can't consent.
We're talking about like touching, groping, rubbing against
Or
someone.
even penetrating.
Yeah, so it can be, and it can be a lot of things.
Now, if you've given consent for that to happen, like to wake up that way, that's different.
But even in that too, my training was you can never give an overall consent. You need to be giving
The
consent.
standing consent,
Yeah,
yeah.
but also like, hey, tomorrow you can totally do that. You should still be checking in with your partner.
Yeah, I absolutely during. I still feel personally uncomfortable about the idea of like, because some.
Just going, unless it's been like, I don't want to put a time limit, but really, if you haven't checked in with him within like, couple minutes before that's going on. Also, no one should be unconscious, right? When you're asleep, you're not quite conscious, okay? So no one should be unconscious when you're starting to have any type of thing.
That's what has me feel quite uncomfortable,
Yeah. And
the whole
so,
idea.
well, that's because you have a moral compass. Well
Oh,
done.
thanks.
But yeah, it's so you need to be aware like the other person has to be completely conscious with it, and that allows that other person to make that decision for themselves 100%.
And that's why this is the most common form of sexual assault I see in relationships is, first of all, they hadn't discussed consent. And secondly, they're absolutely doing it while they're asleep. Consent hasn't been discussed. And then the second most common form I see is that the finances are tied to sex. That you won't have money for the groceries if we don't have sex. Like maybe lingerie and money have been laid out, and the wife or girlfriend knows what that means.
It also doesn't have to necessarily be a statement that that partner makes about it. That doesn't have to be a physical statement that they make of like, hey, I'm only going to give this to you if that happens. But it's the understanding of, okay, if we sleep together tonight, I know tomorrow he'll give me the grocery money, so I might as well do that tonight kind of thing. So there are any type of expectations that's not on equal ground with it. Jenny, we're going to say something.
As we're talking about this, I know that it's complicated, and the reason it's complicated is because it involves human beings, right? So human beings are complicated, relationships are complicated. And it's important to understand that there's the legal definition we talked about, the legal definition and the emotional definition. And it's important that if you feel whether there's a legal standing or not, if you feel like your boundaries were crossed sexually and you're experiencing some of the symptoms that we've talked about, that it would be important for you to go and talk to a therapist and process what's going on. We've talked about how not black and white, how gray trauma can be. And as therapists, our job is to advocate for people's healing. And so if you're feeling like, hey, I did get in this relationship and I said yes, and now I'm struggling with my how I functioned in that relationship, that comes in with that second most prevalent symptom, which is shame. That a lot of people who experience this type of abuse actually are then shamed that they experienced it, that they went into that fawn response, or that they were recovering from other traumas and they felt safer in the relationship. So they said yes to something that they didn't feel was safe for them. And so I want to make sure that we say as therapists that there is the legal definition, but there's also the emotional experience of having an unwanted or unhealthy sexual experience. And that has effects on you. And you can come in and you can explain it to a therapist and they can help you understand it. Whether it meets the legal definition or not, we can have that conversation and help you move into healthier relationships. Because what I see a lot is that people who experience an unwanted sexual experience then go through normal curiosity and healing, and then sometimes they will seek out additional sexual experiences that they can have control over. And so they might even, you can see that both ends of the spectrums, they might avoid all sexual experience, or they might explore lots of different sexual experiences because they were introduced to it so young and they're trying to regain control. And so when we talk about these things, it's important to recognize that whatever your response was, your brain was trying to move you to safety. And that includes, like, if you were abused and then you went out and you maybe said, you know what, I had a bunch of partners and I'm not sure now how I felt about that. And going back to what Haley was saying before, that doesn't feel like a hell yes and a high five experience. I'm kind of not sure how I feel. That would be something to bring into therapy and say, let's talk about that. Let's heal from it. And let's now move into a more healthy sexual realm for you moving forward. Because my goal as a therapist is that everybody can have that healthy sexual relationship and healthy emotional relationship.
So what are resources in addition to therapy out there?
Well, one of the ones that I like is more alternative to therapy, but it can actually be run through a therapist. So I've mentioned before trauma-sensitive yoga. One of the reasons, especially for sexual victims, in my earlier career as a therapist, I worked with sexual violence survivors and at a nonprofit, and we offered this as one of our groups. And one day I'd love to start it again. But trauma-sensitive yoga is really helpful in the sense of a lot of yoga poses are actually considered, not because they're made to be sexual, but they are very common with common sexual poses and things like that. And also just because they're very vulnerable. You often are, especially cow pose, cat pose, things like that. These are ones that, you know, all fours, very left exposed and things like that. These kinds of poses are ones that your body naturally actually feels comfortable doing as well on its own. And that's why it's kind of part of the yoga pose regimen. But with regular yoga poses and classes, often there are touching involved and it's like, hey, deeper stretch through there. That can actually trigger some really big trauma responses and trauma anxieties. Trauma-sensitive yoga is very much on your own. You make adjustments as you need to. And even with some poses, you don't have to do them entirely because of maybe a trauma history. You could do something that's alternative to it and work your way up to feeling more confident. Essentially, back to what Taylor said of a double betrayal, your body can learn to trust itself more. Your body can learn to say, I can protect you. Here's a way I'm making you stronger. I'm making you more comfortable and confident in how you are reacting. And so that's a huge resource I love giving people on their own. There's also physical classes you can attend. There are people who do specific trainings to get themselves accredited for that. So I would definitely look for any resources when it comes to stretching, yoga. We often have the impulse to hide ourselves when these kinds of events happen to ourselves and we don't trust ourselves to feel safe. Find a way to help yourself, not push yourself into an uncomfortable scenario, but help yourself feel safe and learn how to regain that confidence and comfortable and safety feeling back in like a very slow as you need it process.
So another resource that I really like, as I mentioned, I worked for a retreat, and this is an international resource, that there's a free retreat held by SPREA, as I believe the way you say it, but it's SAPREA.org. And they do a 4-day retreat for women who've experienced childhood sexual abuse. And the cost is only for travel to the retreat. The rest of the retreat is at no cost to the survivor. But they do a lot of education and awareness as well as build community with other survivors that can be really hard because this is a when you can connect to the common humanity of other survivors, it can help with your healing. And so that is one thing that finding a support group that allows for that connection and healing can be really beneficial to you. The other thing I just wanted to mention with what Haley said is that with yoga and at the retreat, we also taught Muay Thai, and you can have trauma-informed Muay Thai, which is a type of martial arts. One of the things that you do is you reconnect to your body. The physical and sexual abuse can move you out of your body, and we can go into dissociation and disconnection from body. And so there can be a lot of healing into and moving into feeling more in control when you do those types of physical experiences. So I really encourage people to look at both the physical movement and how you're treating your physical body, as well as the emotional and mental healing that you need to go through.
Yeah. Just in addition to this, and we'll probably put a link in this in the show notes. One of the books I recommend, especially if you're wanting to look at yoga on your own, it's called Overcoming Trauma Through Yoga, Reclaiming Your Body. It's by David Emerson and Elizabeth Hopper. It is a really great step-by-step guide where it tells you about what things can be helpful for it. It also gives you yoga poses in the end. Like a lot of the groups are actually based off taking the poses from the book and making it a practical experience. So you could actually on your own, if you wanted to look at that, that's a really great resource that you can do on your own. But I would say just in general, if you want specific resources for something that is connecting to you, talk about it with your therapist. Research on your own if you want. We've had a lot of experience on our own of looking for specific resources for specific people and what they're going through. And so we would love to help try to find those resources for you.
One of the other things that we didn't directly communicate is that a lot of people experience sexual abuse because they do have a hard time processing, and because they can go through body numbing, that they do struggle sometimes with their health, and this includes a healthy weight. Sometimes this is for protection. People put on excess weight to protect themselves from other people. Sometimes it's because their limbic brain moves into pleasure seeking in ways that are more safe and comfortable for them. So if you are working on your physical health, make sure that you're working with somebody who understands and can be trauma informed about that experience, because there can be a lot of shame inadvertently happening that can be connected to early trauma or sexual trauma. So it's just really important that anytime you go working with the body, in any way, that you're really focusing on working with somebody who understands the effects of trauma and that relationship you have with your body.
Thanks for listening. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Please feel free to rate, subscribe, and review. If you want to find us on social media, we're on Instagram and Facebook at Fate Resilience. We'd love to hear from you.